We had already reached this table in slide 15 when we adjourned last week, but I haven't really talked about the specifics of it, and I'm not going to read every little word to you, but the major point here as we get into the protein section of the survey of the survey of macromolecules is that proteins have a huge diversity of functions. Every important thing that a cell does, nearly everything that it does, involves a protein in some way. Proteins do just about everything in cells, which is why I keep saying that it's proteins that directly give an organism its traits. The genes tell the organism how to build the proteins, but it's the proteins and what they do that actually allow the things to happen in the cell and give the cell its traits, or give the organism its traits. Well, you can see here that there are many functions listed, and these are just categories of functions, so there's many different examples for each of these categories. That alone says that there's a diversity of functions, but they're also radically diverse. These functions are very different from each other. For instance, there are several different proteins, I shouldn't say several, it's much more than several, that act as enzymes. We'll talk much more about enzymes, but enzymes are proteins that act as catalysts. And catalysts are substances that are not reactants in reactions, but they help reactions to happen. They speed them up, in other words. In what we call life, which is the chemical reactions that are occurring in the cells, metabolism, in other words, is life. There are not only thousands of reactions, there's many more, there's trillions of reactions in your body, but there are thousands of different kinds of reactions, and each of these requires its own catalyst, its own specific catalyst for that kind of reaction in order to happen quickly enough to keep you alive. And that's why a big part of your genome, which is all of your genes combined, is dedicated to coding for how to build not just proteins, but specifically proteins that are going to act as enzymes. So that functional category just by itself is indispensably important for life. But you have all these other major categories of functions as well. Structural proteins are common. We talked about structural polysaccharides, which are important for certain structures. Well, proteins also form a lot of structures. You can see examples for each of these silk fibers, collagen in your hair, and so on. Storage proteins exist, although this, compared to the other functions listed here for proteins, that's less of a major function. But albumin in egg is a good example. That's protein for the purpose of storing nutrients. I've already explained why we don't really store much extra energy as protein, because it's not as energy dense, and so it's a less efficient way. But they exist, storage proteins. Transport proteins is a big category. There's all kinds of different transport proteins. And as we get deeper into studying membranes, including the plasma membrane that every cell includes, we'll see that they are indispensable to life, because if all you have is a membrane purely made out of phospholipids, then certain things that need to get into or out of the cell won't be able to do that, because it's a barrier. So you need transport proteins that are specific for certain substances, allowing those to be brought into the cell or taken out of the cell. There's also transport proteins used for moving things around in your body, for instance. Hemoglobin is a good example of that. One of many plasma proteins, proteins that are part of the liquid component or the plasma of the blood, and hemoglobin's job is to temporarily latch on to oxygen and carbon dioxide, carrying it from one place in the body to another. Hormonal proteins. Hormones are signals. They're not the only signals the body uses, but they are chemical signals, as we've talked about before. And broadly speaking, there are two major categories of hormones, those that are based on proteins and those that are not. And the majority of proteins are, the majority of hormones that you use are protein-based. So that's another important use of them. And then there are receptor proteins, whether those receptors are for hormones or other kinds of signals, and whether the hormones themselves are proteins or not. Remember that no chemical signal, including hormones, has any effect at all unless and until it binds to a receptor of some sort. Well, I just told you that most of the hormones themselves are proteins, but even the ones that aren't have to bind to a receptor, and in all cases, the receptors are proteins. And so there wouldn't be any signaling in the body without any proteins. And then there are contractile and motor proteins. Contractile proteins allow muscles to shorten, which is the only thing muscles can do on their own. They can only pull, they can't push. But they do that by two different kinds of proteins interacting in such a way that they increase their overlap between each other. That's how contractile proteins work. And motor proteins are there to move things around in the cell by walking around on still other proteins that make up the cytoskeleton, as we'll talk about in detail in a different chapter. And then defensive proteins allow organisms to defend themselves against potentially harmful invaders. In other words, especially in multicellular organisms like we are, the cells of the body need to know whether something that's present in the body is part of us or part of something else. And if it's not us, then usually steps are taken to destroy that thing, which could harm us. That's what antibodies are all about. Antibodies themselves are proteins. So a huge set of functions here for proteins. And this actually is not surprising molecularly, because proteins are the most diverse of the four categories of macromolecules when it comes to their shape. And I think I've already mentioned, and I'll say it again, that any protein, whatever it is, has whatever function it has because of its shape. It's able to do its job because of a specific shape. And what's another name for the shape of a protein? The conformation. So a protein has to have the correct shape in order to function, but because of the way proteins are built as polymers out of subunits, there's effectively no limit to the number of shapes that proteins can have. The trick is to knowing how to build them, right? So we have our traits because we only have instructions for building the proteins our body's able to make. But if you think of it from a design perspective, which is not how evolution works, if you were to design proteins in the lab, there is no limit to the number of possible shapes that you could produce. And therefore, there's all kinds of functions that those shapes can be responsible for. Let's go on then and explore the proteins, starting with 16, which is a cartoon of a purple enzyme. The enzyme's obviously not really purple, and it's not really this shape. But this gives you a good idea of an important thing about enzymes that I've mentioned a little bit ago. I said that they are not reactants in reactions. Reactants, remember, if there's a chemical reaction and there are reactants, those reactants get turned into products, right? They get used up by turning into something else. But that's not true for a catalyst. A catalyst in chemistry is not a reactant, otherwise it would get turned into a product. Instead, it's kind of a bystander. Well, I shouldn't say bystander because it's involved, but it doesn't get used up in the process. It helps reactants turn into products. And catalysts aren't required for reactions to occur, but without the help of the catalyst speeding up that reaction, it might take years, decades, or centuries for it to happen, which is obviously too long if you're talking about reactions that have to occur in a cell. This is why enzymes are indispensable to life. It's typical that an enzyme-catalyzed reaction proceeds at least millions of times faster than it would without the enzyme's help. But you can see the reusability. Since catalysts in general, which enzymes are not turned into anything, they're able to go around and around as long as there is more reactant. And what we call the reactant in an enzyme-catalyzed reaction is the substrate. A substrate is a reactant that, if an enzyme is present, will bind temporarily to that enzyme, reversibly, and that binding event, this is another example of a ligand binding to a protein. That binding event causes something to happen that makes the reaction more likely. In this case, just as an example, we're using the hydrolysis of sucrose, breaking the glycosidic linkage between the two monosaccharides that make up sucrose, table sugar. So there's a glucose and a fructose that were originally bonded together, forming sucrose. Now it's being broken down. And so you're breaking that glycosidic linkage. Well, the enzyme helps make that more likely. And when that happens, then the two products, glucose and fructose, get released from the place where on the enzyme where they bound, which is the active site. And the enzyme is back to its original configuration, ready to go again if there's more sucrose present. It's reusable. All right, now to how these proteins are built. 17 is not a protein. This is a monomer. Now remember that of the four categories of macromolecules, three of them qualify as polymers. And those three are polysaccharides. The name kind of tells you that, right? Polysaccharides are polymers made out of monomers called monosaccharides. What's the second one that's a polymer? Nucleic acids, which can also be called, as we'll see when we get to that section, polynucleotides. Nucleic acids or polynucleotides are polymers made out of monomers called nucleotides. And the third polymer class is proteins, which can also be called polypeptides. And their monomers, the subunits that they're built out of, are called amino acids. That's what we're looking at here, a single amino acid, and it's really not an amino acid specifically, a specific amino acid, because we don't know what R is. In other words, this is the molecular structure that every amino acid has to have in order for it to be an amino acid. There has to be a central carbon, the magenta C here, which is the alpha carbon. And you're used to realizing that carbon is tetravalent, right? So it has to form four bonds. In the case of an amino acid, that central carbon is forming four individual or single covalent bonds. And for this whole thing to be an amino acid, three of these things that carbon is connected to have to be exactly this. One of them is this yellow one, which you, even without the label, should recognize as a carboxyl group. Right? There's a carboxyl. One other thing that the carbon is hooked to is a hydrogen atom. The third one, working clockwise, there's no ordering to this, is the salmon-colored highlight here, which you should recognize even without the label as an amino group, nitrogen and two hydrogens. And then the fourth spot, labeled R here, can be anything, at least, I mean, as long as it's an atom, it has to be not just space, an atom or more. So R can be anything else. And Notice, therefore, that the only reason that there are different kinds of amino acids, since all of this has to be exactly the same in all of them, is that R can be anything. The simplest possibility is just to stick another hydrogen, the simplest atom, in the place of R. But it can be any other atom or group of atoms. It's just the rest of the molecule, just like you're used to R being for functional groups. Now, what do we call substances that contain a carboxyl group? What is it? No, hydrocarbons contain only hydrogen and carbon. Not carbohydrates. Carbohydrates is a... they contain carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, but it's a whole different category of molecules. We call substances that contain a carboxyl group... well, I shouldn't say no, not carbohydrates. It's possible for a carbohydrate to contain a carboxyl group. But that's not what we call every substance that contains a carboxyl group. We call them, as a category, carboxylic acids. And that's the acids part of the phrase amino acid. Amino acid is an acid because it's a carboxylic acid by virtue of its carboxyl group. What do we call substances that contain an amino group? Amines, right? So that's the amino part of the phrase amino acid. It has an amino group, and it's a carboxylic acid, and R can be anything you want. Now, 18 shows you 20 different amino acids, and you might read in books or hear it said that there are 20 amino acids. That's not true. There's no limit to the number of possible amino acids, as I just told you. Because there's no limit to what R can be, right? So if you're trying to make amino acids in the laboratory, no limit to the number of different kinds that can be made. But organisms, living things, use the same set of 20 amino acids. It's the same 20 amino acids that all organisms share. This is just one piece of really compelling evidence pointing to the fact that all organisms descended from the original successful cells. We're all descendants from that. That's why we use the same set of 20 amino acids. Okay, so these 20 can be called the biological amino acids. They're certainly not the only chemically existing amino acids. But notice that they're in three major groups here. Also notice that except for the white highlighting here, every one of these is identical. Those are the three things I just said have to be connected to the carbon to make it an amino acid. So the white part in each of these is the R group. That's the only thing that makes them different. But they're grouped into these violet groups here based on the chemical properties of the R groups. And notice that in most of these nonpolar ones, you have a bunch of carbons and hydrogens. That should make sense to you because carbon and hydrogen have about the same electronegativity. Hydrocarbons are nonpolar for that reason. So the R group being nonpolar makes the amino acid nonpolar. In the polar group, whatever the R group has, typically OHs or NHs, or SHs, those all have drastic differences in electronegativity and therefore make the R group polar. And then finally, you have electrically charged, which is beyond polar, right? Polar is partially charged because of unequal sharing, but electrically charged means ionized, so there is an actual positive or negative full charge there in the R group somewhere, like in these negative oxygens here, which makes... actually, electrically charged can be broken down into two subgroups itself. Those that act as acids because they have negative charges, or as bases because they have positive charges. Now, this is truly important because the shape that the protein has, which is everything when it comes to function, is determined by how R groups in different amino acids within the same polymer interact with each other. polar ones are not going to want to interact with nonpolar ones, and so on. So that's going to determine the actual shape. We'll see that in a minute, but in 19, first, let's look at the linking of the monomers together. Each amino acid is a monomer. It's by itself, it's a complete molecule. But as we've already reviewed for other large molecules, you build them up by linking together smaller pieces in reactions called what? What are the reactions that build bigger molecules out of smaller pieces for these macromolecules? No, hydrolysis is exactly the opposite. Lysis means splitting. So hydrolysis breaks bigger pieces into smaller. Yes, dehydration is the opposite of hydrolysis. Dehydration joins things together to form a bigger molecule. And remember, it's called dehydration because to do that you have to take H off of one piece, OH off the other piece, that combine to form water that's taken out of the situation. It's dehydration, removal of water. So when we did that for two monosaccharides to form a disaccharide or a bigger polysaccharide, what did we call the resulting covalent bond? What kind of covalent bond links monosaccharides? A glycosidic linkage or bond, yes. That was in its own category. We're in the proteins category now, right? So, but just to further the review, when you build up a fat, you also use a dehydration reaction to join the fatty acids to the glycerol. But that bond gets its own name, which is what? No, that's between monosaccharides. That's the one we just said. I'm talking about fatty acids linked to the glycerol within a fat or triglyceride. That's an ester linkage, right? Same process, dehydration, but the bond gets a different name. Well, we have the same process again here when we want to build a protein by linking amino acids together. And once again, the bond gets its own name, which is a peptide bond. That's what's forming here. And this is why when you have not just a single amino acid, but a string of them, which requires a separate peptide bond for each pair of amino acids linked together, then the whole polymer is called a polypeptide. So it's the word polypeptide tells you it's a polymer with the polymer, but the peptide is not the monomer. The peptide is the bond between monomers. Whereas the word polysaccharide, for instance, is named for the monomers itself, right? And as we'll see, polynucleotides is as well. But peptide bond is how you link together two amino acids. And importantly, unlike a glycosidic linkage between two monosaccharides, there is only one way to link two amino acids together. Let me remind you what I mean by unlike monosaccharides. Think back to the monosaccharides, and keep in mind they have to be in the ringed form to do that, right? To link two monosaccharides together, they can't be in the linear form, they have to be in ringed form. But in each ring, each individual monosaccharide, there's multiple H's and OH's you can choose from to make that glycosidic linkage with another monosaccharide. Which is why a complex carbohydrate, a disaccharide or bigger, can be branched, right? Because the same monosaccharide can be simultaneously hooked via different glycosidic linkages to different monosaccharides. That forms the branching. Does that ring a bell? Or does it make sense? You have any idea what I'm talking about here? Okay. What I mean is, if you have a monosaccharides and they have H's and OH's on all around them, you can form one here and you can also form another one here. That's a branch point. Right? Well, that's not the case with amino acids. There's only one way you can hook two amino acids together. Now, keep in mind that to be amino acids, they have to each individually have a carboxyl on one side and an amino group on the other side, right? Otherwise, they wouldn't be an amino acid. And both of those groups are used for a peptide bond. But it's the amino group of one amino acid that is bonded to the carboxyl group of the next amino acid to form one peptide bond holding those two amino acids together. That's what's happening here. And OH is being lost from the carboxyl group, and H from the amino group of the other amino acid. Out comes water, allowing the carbon and the nitrogen to bond together in a peptide bond. Now, instead of having one amino acid, you have a string of two amino acids. Okay? And that pattern can go on as long as you like. There's no limit to how long the resulting polymer is. But there's never going to be branching because there aren't multiple choices of places on each amino acid where you can make the bond. You see the difference there with respect to monosaccharides? No branching here. So the resulting polymer is called a polypeptide because of the bonds that it includes. All right, and it's also important to note while we're on this slide that not only is there no branching, but the peptide bonds between the carboxyls and the aminos are the only thing holding this polypeptide together along its length. Each amino acid, of course, has an R group, but the R groups are not connected to each other in adjacent amino acids. That's not at all holding the thing together. They're just hanging off of the chain. The chain itself is the peptide bonds between amino and carboxyl groups of each amino acid. Okay? Let's then go to 20. Now, there's different ways to depict polypeptides. Two are shown here. A ribbon model is typical. We also can nowadays make pseudo three-dimensional space-filling models, which are nice to look at, but they don't really serve quite as good a purpose as ribbon models do, in my opinion, because the important thing about a ribbon model, so-called because it's the overall polypeptide is depicted as a ribbon, is that it reminds you of what I just told you. There is no branching that is occurring. Each individual polypeptide, however big it is, however long it is, has two ends, just like a ribbon does. And it can you can fold that ribbon up into a shape three-dimensionally, which is exactly what polypeptides do, but it still has two ends somewhere, and the ribbon model reminds you of that. It tells you that this is a single polypeptide. The yellow things are covalent bonds that we'll talk about later. They are examples of sulfhydryl groups getting together to form disulfide bridges, but I'll mention that again later to explain it. The important point here is that this single ribbon-like polypeptide, after it has been produced, in other words, after you lay down the specific sequence of amino acids forming peptide bonds between them to make the polypeptide, it doesn't stay as a linear sequence of amino acids. I mean, the sequence is going to remain, but it doesn't stay as a stretched out molecule. Once it's built, it's going to assume some three-dimensional shape, just like this ribbon does, and that shape is what allows that protein to function the way it does. In this case, we have lysozyme. The example doesn't matter here, but this is an example of an enzyme, which is why it ends in zyme. And enzymes, as I told you a little bit ago, have active sites on them, some part of the shape that's just right to receive a specific substrate. So shape is everything, but not just for enzymes, for all proteins. Yeah?
So at what point is it considered a protein? Is it two or more amino acids grouped together?
Well, it's kind of a word game because you can talk about dipeptides, tripeptides, just like for monosaccharides, disaccharides. Eventually they become polysaccharides. there's no magic number where we, that it's a cutoff, but a typical polypeptide is at least tens, typically hundreds or thousands of amino acids long. Okay, and I'll have more to say about the word polypeptide in a minute. 21, though, is just another depiction here of two actual proteins from two different, well, not organisms, because the virus isn't an organism, but two different biotic entities from a human antibody. That's one protein. And the reason these things work to recognize foreign material is because they have exactly the right shape that is complementary, just like a lock and key, to the shape of that invader. And this is exactly when you're vaccinated, what spurs the body into creating a bunch of copies of that particular shaped antibody, so that if you're exposed to the naturally occurring real antigen, or virus in this case, you'll already have an army of these things on hand to attack them. Okay, now let's get back to shape. In slide 22, we have four different levels of protein shape, or protein structure, I should say, not specifically shape. It's better to use the word structure here, but they involve shape. And you can see that the words are primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary. That just means first, second, third, fourth level. Okay, now, every single protein has features at least three of these levels of structure. The first three, at least. And some, but only some, proteins, in addition to those three, have the fourth level as well, quaternary. And here's where I have to tell you that the words polypeptide and protein are not always interchangeable terms. They sometimes are, they sometimes are not. Here's the difference. The word polypeptide always refers to a single ribbon. In other words, one sequence of amino acids linked together. So there's two ends. It's non-branching, just like a ribbon. That's a polypeptide. That's what the word polypeptide always means. Some proteins consist of just that one polypeptide. Okay? So in that case, the word polypeptide and protein do mean the same thing for that particular protein. But there are plenty of examples of more complex proteins that are not made of just one polypeptide. They're made of at least two, and possibly more. And in that case, the word polypeptide and the word protein do not mean the same thing. In that case, polypeptide refers to just part of the overall protein. Now, when I say that some proteins are made out of multiple polypeptides, I don't mean that you make individual polypeptides, each of which is like a string of beads, and you hook them end to end together. If you do that, you're back to having just one polypeptide. It's just longer, right? So that's not what's happening here. In these more complex proteins, which we call multimeric proteins, there are two or more polypeptides, and they can be identical polypeptides or different, but there's two or more of them. They are somehow complex together, but they remain individual polypeptides. Okay? But the way that they come together makes up the entire protein. So that's why the words protein and polypeptide in that case do not mean the same thing. This will become more clear as we go through the definitions of these structures, these levels of structure. The simplest, the first listed here, is the primary structure. Primary structure simply refers, and always refers, when you're talking about proteins, to the specific sequence of amino acids that makes up that one polypeptide. All right. Any given polypeptide has its primary structure, which is simply the order of amino acids used. Now, there's 20 choices, remember. Organisms use 20 biological amino acids. So this is very analogous to building a string of beads when you build a polypeptide. But you have to imagine that you have 20 different kinds of beads to work with. And so even if you, before you even link any two together, you have 20 different choices, right? If you just make a tiny, it's not even a polypeptide yet, you just link two together, you have 20 times 20 different overall choices, right? 20 choices for the first, and for each of those you have 20 choices for the second. So there's already 400 ways that you can make just two amino acids linked together. And then 40 to the third power for three, and so on. If you have 1,000, which is not a very big protein, there's plenty of proteins that are 1,000 amino acids big, that would be 40 to the 1,000th power, which if you want to use your calculator will probably give you an error because it's such a ridiculously huge number. This is why there's no limit to the number of proteins that could be built. You just don't have the instructions for those. All right? Anyway, back to this building a string of beads. For any string that you make, there's going to be, first of all, how many amino acids you use, how many beads you use, but also the specific sequence, okay? Both of those are features of what we call the primary structure. And here you just have an example, glycine, proline, threonine. These are all these three-letter abbreviations denote one of the 20 amino acids. So that's all primary structure is. And that's really important because all of the higher levels of structure are a consequence of the primary structure. The primary structure is what you build and what the cell builds at the ribosome using the instructions that are in messenger RNA. Okay, it lays down the specific sequence. Once that is in place, then you can talk about secondary structure, which refers to whether or not there are these repeating motifs that are not the entire polypeptide big, but any given polypeptide might or might not include either of these two major repeating structures, which are called beta-pleated sheets and alpha helices, which is the plural of helix. A helix is a corkscrew shape. A pleated sheet is an accordion shape. And you see these over and over because they're functional for various reasons. But how many there are, if any, and where they are in the polypeptide, we call the secondary structure. Tertiary structure refers to the overall three-dimensional shape of a single polypeptide. How it folds up the entire string into whatever three-dimensional shape, that's the tertiary structure. And so if you're talking about one of these proteins, I said, that consists of just a polypeptide, then you're done. Tertiary structure is the overall shape of the protein in that case because the protein is the polypeptide. But if you are one of the multimeric proteins, then in addition to that tertiary structure, you have quaternary structure. Multimeric, by the way, notice is basically the same word as polymer. Multimer and polymer really mean many parts. But they used multi because each individual polypeptide is already a polymer. They're already using that word there. A multimer is multiple polymers. All right? And not all proteins are multimeric. So only the ones that have two or more polypeptides making them up have this quaternary structure, only the multimeric proteins. This one has, it looks like it has at least three. I can't tell from the picture how many there are, but as long as it's two or more, It has quaternary structure. And the quaternary structure is simply the overall three-dimensional arrangement of multiple constituent polypeptides in a multimeric protein. Does that make sense?
So are those like bonded together somehow?
Well, yeah. This is what I was trying to say before. They're bonded together, but not by taking one polypeptide and another polypeptide and linking them together end to end. That would just make a bigger polypeptide. So they're held in place by hydrogen bonding and in various ways, but each individual polypeptide here remains one ribbon with two ends. And this one has its own ribbon with two ends and so on. Okay, well, speaking of hydrogen bonding, 23 shows you four major bonding forces that can stabilize the structure of even individual polypeptides. So this applies to just single polypeptide proteins or multimeric proteins. But there's four major categories shown here. In one of the cases of the blue, like they were running out of colors, this one up here, the hydrogen bond, these hydrogen bonds are just like any other hydrogen bond that we've already talked about, right? That occurs when you have polar R groups in this case. So the purple thing here, the ribbon, represents the backbone holding the polypeptide together. In other words, the peptide bonds between adjacent amino acids all along the length, between amino group and carboxyl group. Hanging off of that ribbon, not shown in detail here, are all the various R groups. And so here what we're looking at is not bonding between adjacent R groups. Adjacent means they're next to each other in the sequence. These are non-adjacent R groups, maybe way far apart when you think about the stretched out sequence. But when you bend that ribbon into a certain shape, then certain non-adjacent R groups are going to come into contact with each other. And they might like being in contact with each other depending on the chemical properties of the R groups. That's why having polar R groups, non-polar R groups, and charged R groups matters. That's why it determines what shape the overall polypeptide is going to have. One possibility is for an R group to form a hydrogen bond with another R group somewhere else in the sequence, but that come together because of bending. And as we've already talked about, that's not a very strong bond, right? It's not a chemical bond, but it's stronger than nothing, and therefore helps to stabilize the overall shape, which is really important because the shape gives it its function. In pink, we have hydrophobic interactions, which are even less strong, actually, but they're also important. Notice that we have nothing but carbons and hydrogens here. So you might have been thinking that I was lying to you before when I said that hydrocarbons are nonpolar, and therefore they don't really want to... they don't have partial charge and therefore shouldn't be attracted to each other. Well, it turns out that if things are just right, they can be. And I don't want to get too bogged down in this, but if you have, just for simplicity, a CH on one R group and a CH on another, it's equal sharing of the pair of electrons in each of these two, right? Because they're equal electronegativities. But at any given moment, those shared electrons have to be somewhere. They spend about equal time with the carbon and the hydrogen, but they have to be somewhere at any given moment, right? If they happen to get into the position where in this R group they'll be up here at the same time that they'll be here in the other R group, and then they'll switch places over and over in synchrony, then that would actually make these have tiny, tiny opposite charges because wherever the electron is at the moment makes it slightly negative. You see what I'm saying there? And that's what we call hydrophobic interactions involving hydrophobic, in other words, nonpolar R groups coming together and having the oscillation of their electrons be just right to slightly hold them together. And this is how certain things can walk on a glass ceiling, certain organisms, because of hydrophobic interactions between their feet and the glass. Did you have a question?
Is that kind of like how the polysaccharides, the glucose rings, open and close all the time?
Well, it's true that the rings open and close all the time, but that's not a hydrophobic interaction. The hydrophobic interactions are between different... Well, yes, it's part of the same overall molecule because it's a polymer, but these R groups are totally separate in a sense. They're not forming... They're not sharing anything. It's just that when the electron is here on the carbon on the top one and on the hydrogen on the bottom one, then this will be slightly positive, this will be slightly negative, just for the very short time. And then the very next moment, it'll be reversed. The shared electron will be down here and down there, so this will be slightly negative, this will be slightly positive. So it keeps going back and forth, negative and positive, but just in the right way to hold them together. Now, the third one in yellow is the one that I told you I would get back to. Those little yellow bars in that lysozyme slide a few slides ago were an example of disulfide bridges. And these are covalent bonds and therefore chemical. They are much stronger than hydrogen bonds or hydrophobic interactions. And they therefore really stabilize the shape of the polypeptide if the polypeptide features them. They don't have to have disulfide bridges. This happens, though, when you have a sulfhydryl-containing R group. Cysteine is an amino acid that has a sulfhydryl in it, if you look at the table of 20, all the 20 listed. Remember that a sulfhydryl is an SH. If you have another sulfhydryl on a different R group that come into contact because of bending, then the sulfhydryls will lose their hydrogens, which allows them to sew their sulfurs together covalently. And that really locks it into place well, makes it a strong protein. Your hair has a lot of this, which is why if you burn your hair accidentally or for fun, you'll have that sulfur smell because there's so many disulfide bridges in there. And then you can also have ionic bonds form, as long as you have a negatively charged R group coming into contact with a positively charged R group because of bending. So all of these combined really determines what the overall shape of that polypeptide is going to be, the tertiary structure. And that all comes from the primary structure, the sequence of amino acids, because that tells you where each R group is, and they're only going to be able to fold in one shape that is best to satisfy the interactions that we just listed here. Okay? Now, if conditions change, environmental conditions change, that shape will not be the same. But in conditions in which the organism usually lives and is trying to maintain those conditions, it will have a specific shape or conformation. 24 is not really about the example proteins here, collagen on the left and hemoglobin on the right. Those are just examples. What's illustrated here, though, is that proteins overall can be grouped based on overall shape into two categories, which are fibrous proteins, represented here by collagen. Fibrous proteins are longer than they are wide. They form fibers or filaments, and they therefore are usually structural proteins, things that act as little ropes, for instance. The other category is the globular proteins. Globular proteins are more or less compact, not perfect spheres, but not particularly long in any of the three dimensions. And they can be just about all the other kinds of functions, functional proteins, including enzymes and things like that, transport proteins and so on. just by coincidence, it's not the point of this slide, but notice that these both of these examples are multimeric proteins. Collagen is a multimeric protein that's made out of identical subunits. So all you have to have to be multimeric are two or more polypeptides. They don't have to be different kinds of polypeptides. Each of these three strands is identical, but they're still separate polypeptides. Hemoglobin has four polypeptides, but it's two of one type and two of another type. And now, speaking of hemoglobin, slide 25 uses this as an example again to really point out the importance of primary structure. I just told you that primary structure determines all the higher level structures, right? The shape and therefore the function. We can really see how important that sequence is. This does not imply, or it shouldn't imply, that hemoglobin is made out of just seven amino acids. This is just the first seven of however many, which I don't know exactly how many are in this subunit, that make up one beta subunit. And a whole hemoglobin molecule is two beta subunits plus two alpha subunits. But here we're looking at just the beginning sequence of one beta subunit. And it's in normal hemoglobin, which we would call the wild type, it's valine, histidine, leucine, and so on. All right? Certain humans feature a variant or a mutant type of beta subunit for the hemoglobin. But it starts out exactly the same for the first five. Six, instead of being glutamic acid, as in the normal one, it's valine. And then all the rest of them are still normal. So it's just one amino acid that got swapped for a different bead in this version of hemoglobin subunit. And just that one difference, that tiny difference, is enough to cause sickle cell disease. On the bottom you see a normal-shaped erythrocyte, human red blood cell, which is a biconcave disc. But if you have this abnormal hemoglobin because of this mutation in the DNA that tells the cell to put valine here instead of glutamic acid, then the hemoglobin clumps together and forms misshapen red blood cells, but also the individual hemoglobin molecules are not doing their job, which is to carry oxygen and carbon dioxide. So it's bad effects to have sickle cell disease. We'll talk about this example again when we get back to, or when we get into the DNA half of the semester. 26. I just talked about shape being everything, or conformation, and a normal protein, meaning a protein that is in the shape it's supposed to be for the job it's supposed to function at, will have that shape because of the various interactions between non-adjacent R groups that we just talked about. That's what's going to cause it to assume that three-dimensional shape, the way those R groups interact with each other. But the environment also affects shape, not just the sequence of amino acids in the polypeptide itself, also the factors in the environment can come into play. And I've already talked about the two biggies, the two that matter the most, when I gave you a slide about acid rain. Remember, we talked about acid precipitation. At the time, I told you that the two big factors in the environment, the two big variables that can change the shape of proteins, are temperature and pH. They're not the only ones, but either one by itself can drastically change the shape of a protein without the variable itself being changed very much at all. And when that happens, whether it's by temperature change, pH change, or any other reason, presence of some chemical, for instance, if the shape gets changed from its normal shape, then we call that denaturation. But there are degrees to denaturation. Any sort of denaturation, of course, is going to affect function because the function requires that specific shape. Denaturation is now a different shape. So at least the protein is doing its job differently, usually just not quite as well, if it's even slightly denatured. If it's only slight denaturation, though, and if you remove whatever it is that caused the denaturation, like you restore the normal temperature or the pH, for instance, then you could have renaturation of that polypeptide, and it could assume its proper shape again if the environmental conditions are restored to normal. This is a major reason why we have homeostasis. We're trying to keep variables within limits that, if exceeded, would lead to proteins changing their shape irreversibly. We would lose the function of our proteins. That's what would kill us. So you can have renaturation, maybe, but if it's too drastic a denaturation, then there's no hope for that individual polypeptide. It's not completely worthless. It's not going to ever function again as a polypeptide, but it's still made out of amino acids, so it can be recycled. You just break it down into amino acids and build either another one or some other totally different polypeptide using those as monomers. By the way, this wouldn't necessarily kill the organism, because even if this is completely denatured and destroyed, we can build another polypeptide, right? That's why we have genes. We just need to go back to the library and take out the manual for how to build that particular polypeptide. We call that manual a gene. That's what genes are. Yeah.
So is this like a pretty quick process? Like, if we were to go stand in the freezer for 10 minutes, but our proteins change? Or like...
Well, they would at least slightly change, at least some of them, because we also have mechanisms to keep the core at proper temperature, even though our skin temperature might be. And keep in mind that part of the skin that you actually touch is made of nothing but dead cells. So that's what gets the coldest, actually. But yes, I mean, that's part of why you can't indefinitely tolerate cold. You eventually will die. Now in 27, speaking of shape, some proteins, when they're built, when they're straight off the assembly line and they have the primary structure, the sequence of amino acid, the conditions within the cell, the liquid portion of the cytoplasm, which we call the cytosol, will be just right for them to, without any help, assume their three-dimensional shape because of their R groups. So they don't need any help. Other proteins, though, are not going to get their correct shape if they're left on their own. They have to actually be temporarily and slightly separated from the rest of the environment within the cell for that protein to have its correct shape. And that requires the help of still other proteins called chaperone proteins or chaperonins that act like little canisters. So this canister-looking thing is one protein. It has a specific shape with a hollow interior that makes it like a canister. And then this brand new polypeptide that hasn't folded up yet, but it has just been built, is inserted into this, keeping it away from all the other parts of the cell, giving it its own proper environment for it to fold up properly, and then it gets ejected and it can do whatever job it does. So it's proteins helping other proteins take on their normal shape. Well, 28 is the segue between this protein section or polypeptide section and the final section, the only one of the macromolecules that we haven't discussed, is nucleic acids. And this involves both proteins and nucleic acids, and it shows you in schematic form what I've been saying many times in different ways throughout these lectures, that nucleic acids are used to specify how to build polypeptides. So we're using here a eukaryotic cell as an example. You know it's eukaryotic because it has a nucleus. But even if this were a prokaryotic cell, you would still have DNA, right? It just wouldn't be in its own compartment. The idea here is that DNA is nucleic acid. It's one major category of nucleic acid. And that's what holds the information in the library as a how-to manual that I just used as an example before. Each gene is a manual. But it's not a manual for how to build a protein. It's indirectly a manual for how to build a protein, but not directly. The overall DNA is like a library that contains a bunch of manuals. Each gene is a manual. But unlike many books in the library, a gene is like a non-circulating book, meaning you're not allowed to check it out. You have to, if you're going to use it, you have to stay there in the library, right? Like a reference book, for instance. Well, if you're going to use this thing to build, as a how-to manual for how to build something, and you can't build it in the library, then for it to be useful, you're going to have to rewrite that book, right? The instructions. And the word for rewriting is transcribing. That's why this first part of the overall process of gene expression, which we call it, is transcription. And if you think back to the first week when I asked, when I told you what the first, what the two major jobs of DNA are in any organism, hopefully you remember that one of those was transcription. Transcription is the only thing that part of gene expression that DNA is directly involved in. All right, so transcription uses that manual while still in the library and rewrites it in the form of a different nucleic acid called messenger RNA. So this is the copy that you make that you're allowed to take home, in other words. And you put the manual back in the library. DNA is done at that point. But now the information that used to be in DNA is in messenger RNA. That's what transcription does. Well, then messenger RNA can leave, if this is a eukaryotic cell, it will leave the nucleus and go out into the cytoplasm where a ribosome is. That's what this brown thing is, and we'll talk more about ribosomes in the next chapter. A ribosome is a little molecular machine that builds the protein, the polypeptide. And it does that because messenger RNA tells the ribosome how many amino acids are going to be used, how long the string of beads is, and what each position is of the 20 choices of amino acid that each position can have. It tells it which amino acid to use. So that's the purple sequence of beads here. Each one is an amino acid strung together with a peptide bond. Well, that process of actually stringing together the amino acids to build the polypeptide is called translation. That's where it's actually built. DNA isn't involved in that because you left the manual in the library. RNA is involved in that, and ribosome is involved in that. But the major point here, the reason this is kind of a segue slide, is because this involves the fourth category, nucleic acids, and it also involves the category we just got through, polypeptides. But this also shows you in pictures what I've kept saying in terms of your body only being able to make roughly 20,000 types of proteins, because that's the only ones it ever has instructions for. If you were to put another manual in the library through genetic engineering, then you could make a new protein that you've never been able to make before. Okay, now we are officially into the nucleic acids section. Slide 29 here shows you a very, very short nucleic acid on the left. But it's enough to show you that any given nucleic acid is not only a polymer, as we've already talked about, but it is a sequence of monomers, each of which is called a nucleotide. All right, so you have the three polymer classes. Polysaccharides made out of monomers called monosaccharides. Polypeptides made out of monomers called amino acids. Now we're in the third polymer class. Nucleic acids, which can also be called polynucleotides, because their polymer is made out of monomers called nucleotides. All right? So now, if you want to think about it as a string of beads, each bead is a nucleotide, not an amino acid. I said this is a short polynucleotide because DNA, for instance, which is a polynucleotide, is millions of nucleotides long. Just one molecule of DNA is millions of nucleotides long, not the four that we see here. So this is tiny in length, but you can see that it's made of individual nucleotides. Each of these is a nucleotide, and you see one in detail in the center. So even though nucleotide refers to one subunit, a single nucleotide still consists of three parts itself. as you can see on the shapes here. So to be a nucleotide, there have to be three things in place. One of which, in green, is some sort of pentose. Now, what does pentose tell you? The word? What is a pentose?
Is it five?
Five what? Five sugars? No, it's one sugar.
Is it five?
Five carbons. It's a five carbon containing sugar. Right. And pentose, remember, is not a substance, it's a category. There's multiple pentoses. Well, for the purposes of building nucleic acids, or polynucleotides, there are two available pentoses to choose from, which are shown in the bottom right. There is ribose in red here, in red letters. This is ribose. And there's deoxyribose. They're both pentoses because they have five carbons. Remember, if there's something other than C listed on a corner, then it's whatever that is. But an unlabeled corner is a C. So there's one, two, three, four, and then five in this sugar. There's also five here. Okay? So any given nucleotide contains a pentose sugar, and that pentose is either ribose or deoxyribose. More about that in a minute. But a pentose sugar is one of the three components of a nucleotide. I mentioned this sugar first because the other two components are both connected, but in different places, to that pentose, as you can see in the central figure here. One of the things that are connected to the pentose, shown in yellow here, hopefully you know even without the label that that's a phosphate group, as we've already talked about. Yeah, go ahead.
Is a pentose also a monosaccharide?
Yes. Now, a phosphate group is the same as any other phosphate group. So there aren't multiple kinds of phosphate groups. Okay? But that's the second component, or it's two of three. And the third component, also connected to the same pentose sugar, but in a different place, is this orange one, which is a nitrogenous base. Nitrogenous simply means containing nitrogen. And just like amino acids, there's really no limit to the number of amino acids that could be built in a laboratory. There's no limit to the number of nitrogenous bases either. But when it comes to naturally occurring organisms building polynucleotides out of nucleotides, the nitrogenous bases come in five varieties, shown in the upper right here. All right, cytosine, thymine, uracil, adenine, guanine, each of which has a one-letter abbreviation, are the five normal nitrogenous bases in biological nucleic acids. But there's two categories of nucleic acids, DNA and RNA. All right? DNA uses four of those five. RNA uses four of those five, but it's not the same four. So in any given nucleotide, if it's going to be part of DNA, the nitrogenous base is either cytosine, thymine, adenine, or guanine. If it's an RNA, it's made out of RNA nucleotides, and the nitrogenous base is either cytosine, uracil, adenine, or guanine. In other words, RNA uses uracil instead of thymine, whereas DNA uses thymine instead of uracil. Now back to this sugar. I said there's two choices of sugar for a nucleotide. But within a nucleic acid, there is no choice. What I mean by that is that any given polynucleotide or complete nucleic acid is either a DNA or an RNA. Those stand for deoxyribonucleic acid for DNA and ribonucleic acid for RNA. Each of those is made up of however many nucleotides hooked together. But if it's a DNA nucleic acid, if it's a DNA in other words, then every single nucleotide in that sequence has deoxyribose as the sugar. So there's not really a choice within, you know, if it's going to be DNA, then every sugar is going to be deoxyribose. And if it's an RNA, every sugar is going to be ribose. Now, speaking of these two, shown in the bottom right, compare their structural formulae, and they're almost identical, notice. The only difference is right here at the second carbon. The carbon itself is the same, but what's connected to it is different. In ribose, you have a hydroxyl group, one of several, connected to that second carbon, right? But in deoxyribose, you have just hydrogen, not a hydroxyl. In other words, deoxyribose is named for the fact that it's just like ribose without an oxygen. That's what deoxy means, without an oxygen. So deoxyribose, if you don't have the oxygen here. All right? So if you're building a DNA, there's really no choice of sugar. It's always deoxyribose. And since all phosphates are the same, that means every DNA nucleotide shares these two. It has exactly the same sugar and exactly the same phosphate. And therefore, the only reason that there are different kinds of nucleotides, different beads to work with for DNA, is because there are different choices for nitrogenous base, four different choices. And same thing for RNA, except you're using ribose as the sugar instead of deoxyribose. This is completely analogous to the situation with amino acids. The only thing that makes different kinds of amino acids different is the R group. The rest of it is identical. Also analogous is how nucleotides are put together. Think back to polypeptides that we just talked about. I said that they're unbranching because there's only one way to hook two amino acids together, right? The amino group of one with the carboxyl of the other. Similarly, there's not any branching within a polynucleotide, either a DNA or an RNA, because of the same reason. There's only one way to hook them together, and that is the phosphate of one nucleotide is hooked to the sugar of the next nucleotide, and then its phosphate is hooked to the sugar of the next one, and so on. That's the only thing holding this together along the length, just like the peptide bonds are the only things holding together a polypeptide. The R groups hang off the side and are not involved in maintaining the integrity, right? Same thing here, except the nitrogenous bases are like the R groups of the amino acids. They just hang off of this string. They're not holding it together at all. So the thing that holds it together, since it involves only the sugars and the phosphates, is called the sugar phosphate backbone. The nitrogenous bases, which are the only variable parts of the nucleotides, because there's four choices, are what make this an informational molecule. Whether it's DNA or RNA, it's informational. It's carrying information. And the information exists as the particular sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's if it's DNA. Or A's, U's, C's, and G's if it's RNA. Right? That's what gives it its sequence. I mean, its information. And we'll talk much more about that because we have an entire half of the term to talk about DNA. So we'll get back into things I'm saying here. But in slide 30, which basically ends the chapter, we can see a DNA, and let me just tell you that when we say a single DNA, it's really two polynucleotides. It's two molecules, really, because each strand and the two strands that make up one DNA, each strand by itself is a complete molecule, similar to one polypeptide being a complete molecule that's just part of a multimeric protein. Here we have two polymers held together, not chemically, not with chemical bonds, but with hydrogen bonds, which are what the black ellipses mean, the three dots. Okay? But each ribbon here in this double helix, as it's called because it's two corkscrews, is held together. Each ribbon is held together by the sugar phosphate backbone. That has to be strong, which is why they're covalent bonds. Because if you break that ribbon, you lose the information. The information is the sequence, right? It's an old-fashioned analogy, but like having a box of typesetting letters that are all in place for a newspaper, you drop that on the ground, it no longer has the information, right? So it's important for the sugar phosphate backbone to be strong. That maintains the specific sequence of nucleotides, or of nitrogenous bases. But as we'll see later, it's important for the hydrogen bonds between the nitrogenous bases in the same position but on opposite strands to be separated, because both of the major functions of DNA requires separation of the two strands. That can be done pretty easily because they're hydrogen bonds holding them together, not covalent bonds. All right, I'll see you later today.